I already started the work. I spoke to Rosemary and talked to Barr's neighbors. Then I went back to the hospital. I think we're looking for a guy named Charlie. Small guy, bristly black hair, interested in guns. I got the impression he's kind of furtive. I think he's going to be hard to find.
How long has he been on the scene?
5 or 6 years, apparently. He's the only long-term friend anybody could name, and he's the only one Barr owns up to.
Reacher nodded again. That works for me.
And Barr doesn't know Jeb Oliver and doesn't use drugs.
You believe him?
Yes, I do. Really. Right now, I believe everything he says. It's like he spent 14 years turning his life around, and now he can't believe he went back. I think he's as upset about all this as anyone.
Except the victims.
Give him a break, Reacher. Something weird was going on.
Does this guy Charlie know about Kuwait City?
Barr wouldn't say, but I think he does.
Where does he live?
Barr doesn't know.
He doesn't know?
He just sees him around. He just shows up now and then. Like I said, I think he's going to be hard to find.
Reacher said nothing.
Did you speak to Eileen Hutton?
She's no threat. The army is keeping the lid on.
Did you find the guy that was following you?
No. I didn't see him again. They must have pulled him off.
So we're nowhere.
We're closer than we were. We can start to see a shape. We can see four guys, at least. One, the old guy in the suit. Two, this guy called Charlie. Three, someone big and very strong and left-handed.
Why him?
He killed a girl last night. The old guy is too old, and it sounds like Charlie might be too small. And the physical evidence suggests a left-handed blow.
And number four is the puppet master.
Reacher nodded again. In the shadows somewhere, making plans, pulling strings. We can assume he doesn't run around doing this kind of stuff himself.
But how can we get to him? If he's pulled the guy off your tail, we can assume he's pulled Charlie back too. They're hunkering down.
There's another way. A big, wide highway.
Where?
We missed something very obvious. We spent all this time looking down the wrong end of the gun. All we've done is look at who fired it.
What should we have done?
We should have thought harder.
About what?
James Barr fired 4 times in Kuwait City, and he fired 6 times here.
Okay. He fired 2 more shots here, so...
But he didn't. Not really. Not if you think about it laterally. Truth is, he fired 4 fewer shots here.
That's ridiculous. 6 is 2 more than 4, not 4 fewer.
Kuwait City was very hot. Unbearable in the middle of the day. You had to be nuts to be out and about. The streets were empty most of the time.
So?
So in Kuwait City, James Barr killed every live human he saw. 1, 2, 3, 4. Game over. The street was deserted apart from our 4 guys. They were the only people dumb enough to be out in the heat, and Barr took them all. He ran the table. At the time, it seemed logical to me. He wanted to see the pink mist. It struck me that maybe he might have been satisfied with seeing it once, but apparently he wasn't. So it made some kind of sense that if he didn't stop at 1, he would go all the way until he ran out of targets. And he did. In Kuwait City, he ran out of targets.
Helen Roden said nothing.
But he didn't run out of targets here. There had to have been 12 people in that bottleneck. Or 15. More than 10, anyway. And he had a 10-round magazine, but he stopped shooting after 6. Just stopped. He left 4 rounds in the gun. They're listed right there in Bill Antonio's Dog and Pony Show. And that's what I meant. He fired the most he could fire in Kuwait City, and 4 less than the most he could fire here. Which makes the psychology different here. He chose not to run the table here.
Why? Because he was hurrying?
He had an autoloader. The voicemail recording shows 6 shots in 4 seconds, which means he could have fired 10 in less than 7 seconds. 3 seconds wouldn't have made any kind of a difference to him.
Helen said nothing.
I asked him. When I saw him in the hospital, I asked him how he would have done it, theoretically, like a recon briefing. So he thought about it, He knows the area. He said he would have parked on the highway, behind the library. He said he would have buzzed the window down and emptied the mag. Helen said nothing. But he didn't empty the mag. He stopped shooting after six, just stopped, coldly and calmly, which makes the whole dynamic different. This wasn't a crazy man sent out to terrorize the city on a dare. He wasn't pushed into it just for the fun of the carnage. This wasn't random, Helen. It wasn't psychotic. There was a specific, limited, coherent purpose behind it, which reverses the focus. We should have seen it. We should have seen that this whole thing is about the victims, not the shooter. They weren't just unlucky people in the wrong place at the wrong time.
They were targets?
Carefully chosen. And as soon as they were safely down, Barr packed up and left, with four bullets remaining. A random psycho episode wouldn't have panned out like that. He'd have kept on pulling the trigger until he clicked on empty. So this wasn't a spree. It was an assassination. Silence in the office. We need to look at who the victims were, and we need to look at who wanted them dead. That's what's going to lead us to where we need to be. Helen Roden didn't move. And we need to do it real fast, because I don't have much time, and we already wasted the best part of 3 days looking at everything ass backward. The tired 30-year-old doctor on the sixth floor of the county hospital was finishing up his afternoon rounds. He had left James Barr for last, partly because he wasn't expecting any dramatic change in his condition, and partly because he didn't care anyway. Looking after sick thieves and swindlers was bad enough, but looking after a mass murderer was absurd. Doubly absurd, because straight after Barr was on his feet, he was going to be laid back down on a gurney, and some other doctor was going to come in and kill him. But ethical obligations are hard to ignore, as is habit, as is duty and routine and structure. So the doctor went into Barr's room and picked up his chart, took out his pen, glanced at the machines, glanced at the patient. He was awake, his eyes were moving. Alert, the doctor wrote. Happy? He asked.
Not really.
Responsive, the doctor wrote. Tough shit, he said, and put his pen away. Barr's right handcuff was rattling gently against the cot rail. His right hand itself was trembling and slightly cupped, and the thumb and index finger were in constant motion, like he was trying to roll an imaginary ball of wax into a perfect sphere. Stop that, the doctor said.
Stop what?
Your hand.
I can't.
Is that new?
A year or two.
Not just since you woke up?
No.
The doctor looked at the chart. Age 41. Do you drink?
Not really. A sip sometimes to help me sleep.
The doctor disbelieved him automatically and flipped through the chart to the tox screen and the liver function test. But the tox screen was clear, and the liver function was healthy. Not a drinker. Not an alcoholic, not even close. Have you seen your own physician recently?
I don't have insurance.
Stiffness in your arms and legs?
A little.
Does your other hand do that, too?
Sometimes.
The doctor took out his pen again and scribbled on the bottom of the chart. Observed tremor in right hand, not post-traumatic. Primary diagnosis alcohol unlikely. Stiffness in limbs present. Possible early onset PA?
What's wrong with me?
Shut up, the doctor said. Then, duty done, he clipped the chart back on the foot of the bed and walked out of the room. Helen Roden searched through the evidence cartons and came out with the formal specification of charges against James Barr. Among many other technical violations of the law, the state of Indiana had listed 5 counts of homicide in the first degree with aggravating circumstances, and as due process required, had gone on to list the 5 alleged victims by name, sex, age, address, and occupation. Helen scanned the page, ran her fingers down the columns for address and occupation.
I don't see any obvious connections,
I didn't mean they were all targets, Reacher said. Probably only one of them was. Two, at most. The others were window dressing. An assassination disguised as a spree. That's my guess.
I'll get to work.
I'll see you tomorrow. He used the fire stairs instead of the elevator and got back to the garage unseen. He hustled up the ramp and across the street and under the highway again. The invisible man. Life in the shadows. He smiled. He stopped. He decided to go look for a payphone. He found one on the side wall of a small grocery called Martha's, 2 blocks north of the cheap clothing store he had used. The booth faced a wide alley that was used as a narrow parking lot. There were 6 slanted spaces full of 6 cars. Beyond them, a high brick wall topped with broken glass. The alley turned 90 degrees behind the grocery. He guessed it turned again somewhere and let out on the next block south. Safe enough, he thought. He took Emerson's torn card out of his pocket, chose the cell number, dialed the phone, leaned his shoulder against the wall, and watched both ends of the alley at once and listened to the purr of the ringtone in his ear.
Yes?
Emerson said. Guess who?
Reacher?
You named that tune and won.
Where are you?
I'm still in town.
Where?
Not far away.
You know we're looking for you, right?
I heard.
So you need to turn yourself in?
I don't think so.
Then we'll come find you.
Think you can?
It'll be easy.
You know a guy called Franklin?
Sure I do.
Ask him how easy it'll be.
That was different. You could have been anywhere.
You got the motor court staked out? There was a pause. Emerson said nothing. Keep your people there. Maybe I'll be back. Or on the other hand, maybe I won't.
We'll find you.
Not a chance. You're not good enough.
Maybe we're tracing this call.
I'll save you the trouble. I'm outside a grocery called Martha's.
You should come in from the cold.
I'll trade. Find out who placed the cone in the parking garage, and then I'll think about coming in.
Barr placed the cone.
You know he didn't. His van isn't on the tapes.
So he used another vehicle?
He doesn't have another vehicle.
So he borrowed one?
From a friend? Reacher said. Maybe. Or maybe the friend placed the cone for him. Either way, you find that friend, and I'll think about coming in to talk to you.
There are hundreds of cars on those tapes.
You've got the resources.
I don't trade.
I think his name is Charlie, Reacher said. Small guy, wiry black hair.
I don't trade.
I didn't kill the girl.
Says you.
I liked her.
You're breaking my heart.
And you know I didn't stay at the Metropole last night.
Which is why you dumped her there.
And I'm not left-handed.
I don't follow.
Tell Bel Antonio to talk to your M.E.
We'll find you.
You won't. Nobody ever has before. Then he hung up and walked back to the street, crossed the road and hiked half a block north and took cover behind a stack of unused concrete lane dividers in a vacant lot. He waited. 6 minutes later, 2 cruisers pulled up in front of Martha's grocery. Lights, but no sirens. 4 cops spilled out. 2 went in the store and 2 went to find the phone. Reacher watched them regroup on the sidewalk, watched them search the alley and check around its corner, watched them come back, watched them admit defeat. He saw one of the 4 get on his radio for a short conversation full of defensive body language, raised palms, shrugged shoulders. Then the conversation ended, and Reacher slipped away east, heading back toward the Marriott. The Zec had only a thumb and a single finger remaining on each hand. On the right was a stump of an index finger, blackened and gnarled by frostbite. He had once spent a week outdoors in the winter, wearing an old red army tunic, and the way its previous owner's water canteen had ridden on his belt had worn the fabric of the right pocket thinner than the left. On such trivial differences survival had hung. His left hand had been saved and his right hand lost. He had felt his fingers die from the pinky inward. He had taken his hand out of his pocket and let it freeze hard enough to go completely numb. Then he had chewed off the dead fingers before the gangrene could spread. He remembered dropping them to the ground, one by one, like small brown twigs. His left hand retained the pinky. The middle three fingers were missing. Two had been amputated by a sadist with garden shears. The Zek had removed the other himself, with a sharpened spoon, so as to be disqualified for labor in some machine shop or other. He couldn't recall the specifics, but he remembered a persuasive rumor that it was better to lose another finger than work on that particular detail. Something to do with the overseer. Ruined hands. Just two of many souvenirs of another time, another place. He wasn't very aware of them anymore, but they made modern life difficult. Cell phones had gotten so damn small. Linsky's number was 10 digits long, and it was a pig to dial. The Zek never retained a phone long enough to make it worth storing a number. That would be madness. Eventually, he got the number entered, and he concentrated hard and pressed the call button with his left-hand pinky. Then he juggled the phone into his other palm and cupped it near his ear. He didn't need to hold it close. His hearing was still excellent, which was a miracle all by itself.